Thanks for joining us. I'm Diane Rehm. Invisible is Paul Auster's 15th novel. Many consider it his finest work of fiction. The book explores the intertwining nature of memory and imagination, and how a single dramatic act can have far-reaching consequences. Joining me in the studio for this month's Reader's Review, book critic and blogger Mark Athatakis, creative writing teacher Lisa Page, Washington Post staff writer Neely Tucker. And throughout the hour, we'll take your calls, 800-433-8850, whether you've read this book or not. I think you're going to be interested. Lisa, how'd you feel about this novel?
Well, I was blown away by it. I couldn't put it down. And I've been told that that's the effect Auster has on people. This is my first Paul Auster. So it was a great read.
And you, Mark?
I really enjoyed it. I think it's one of Paul Auster's best novels. I think that oftentimes Paul Auster can be very hit and miss. He can fall into some metafictional rabbit holes, but I think this is one of his most focused and engaging books.
Neely, help me out here.
It's just great characters, and Auster is always writes with a lot of psychological acuity. One of the real gifts that he has is he can write about the intellectual lives of fictional people extremely well. And sometimes it would almost seem it would be hard for the story to keep going that way. But it does, because it's a sort of a thriller that unfolds here about exactly what happens. But that's based on everybody's interior lives and how they relate to each other.
Okay.
So he does that extremely
I gotta
well.
Say, in the fourth part, I think Paul Auster goes kind of nutsy. I think that the fourth part of this novel makes no sense at all.
But I would argue that that's part of the structure that he's playing with in terms of form, because the fourth part is also written in the form of a diary. And that right there is always an unreliable form. So I think that's a point he's trying to make, frankly.
I wouldn't dispute you at all. I was really going along with the first three
just
bits.
Going along
and this is the
time.
Okay, he's going to really bring home the bacon, and here's going to be this big setup scene. And there wasn't any really setup scene. It was just sort of the guy was nuts, and she said, well, you're nuts, and then that was sort of it.
And she goes into this. I mean, we're getting way ahead of the story, and maybe we better go back to the beginning. Who is Adam Walker?
Adam Walker is a 20-year-old Columbia University student who has aspirations to be a poet and a literary figure, and he falls under the curious spell of this older gentleman named Rudolph, who has some past...
Rudolph Bourne.
Right, who has some past history in French intelligence, some very shady parts of his history.
Or does he?
Well, we don't know. We don't know, but we do know that he's very seductive to Adam, that he dangles a few things that are very appealing to him. He
including
offers
his live-in girlfriend.
And second cousin, which becomes an interesting plot point later on as well. So
what happens in the novel at Columbia in the spring of 1967?
Well, what happens is that Adam has offered a couple of things, some more immediately enticing than others. And one of them is to take up the helm of a new magazine, which Rudolph very graciously agrees to underwrite. Apparently, he says in the book, I believe, that he's inherited some money. Mm-hmm. And he says, you can set up this magazine. It's yours to run. Adam puts in a proposal. They're going and talking. And then there's a very dramatic moment in which the central plot point of the entire book, they're walking through a park. They're accosted. And Rudolph apparently stabs their assailant to death. It's very striking because all Adam sees is he sees him stab him once, and he runs off for help. Later, when he comes back, no one is there. The next day in the paper, a couple of days later, he reads that this young man's body was found stabbed 12 times, which is a lot more than he saw. So he becomes convinced that Rudolph Bourne has stabbed this man 12 times and literally gotten away with murder.
Do you think Rudolph Bourne is evil, Lisa?
Oh, I think he's immediately set up that way from the very beginning when he talks about man at his best when he's at war. I may not be quoting it quite right, but at this party where they meet, he talks about that being man at his ultimate. He clearly is... his seduction of Adam Walker is evil in the way that he pulls him in and plays with him around the live-in girlfriend, the fact that Adam Walker is young and innocent and hungry and wanting to be a poet. Rudolph Bourne is a professor at Columbia and, you know, lodges this over him. Yes, he's evil. And he's certainly his identity in terms of whether or not he's in the Secret Service, whether he's a double agent, all of these things are carried through the book.
You know, it's fascinating because shortly after Adam Walker meets Rudolph Bourne and Margot, Bourne's live-in girlfriend, and they have Adam to dinner, then Bourne says, "Oh, I have to go out of the country. I have to go to France." Mm-hmm. And Adam and Margot get together for a full 5-day tryst. Mm-hmm. When Bourne comes back, Adam feels terribly guilty, but Bourne, in effect, says, "Oh, don't worry about it. I set you up. Mm-hmm. I don't really care about her." You know... Neely?
Well, you kind of want everybody to behave differently at that point. You want Adam to have the courage of his convictions and says, "Look, I love her now, and, you know, I'll fist fight you on the street over this woman." But he really doesn't. And then you want Rudolph to sort of be enraged about it, or at least have this bonhomme about, "Oh, it's all okay, we are French." And that's not even it either. He's just this evil sort of guy who says, "Yeah, you know, I kind of thought she was bad news anyway, so I left you kids alone, and yeah, she did what I thought, so whatever."
Well, he lives to unsettle people's lives. I mean, you know, the phrase that he says very early on is, and this is the quote, "War is the purest, most vivid expression of the human soul."
Yeah.
That's his philosophy.
War.
Yeah. And, you know, he likes to create battles with people, and I think this is to an end of proving his superiority. And we could talk a little bit later about that last section, but he's high on the mountaintop. He is this controlling figure, and I think that's how Auster wants us to look at him.
Well, earlier on, of course, after the murder of the young man in the park, Adam Walker makes what I think is a fatal mistake right from the start, in that he does not go to the police immediately. Right. He waits. And in that period of waiting, Bourne not only skips town, he skips the country. And then nobody is going to be able to get him back from Paris to stand trial.
I also think it's important to bring in the issue of race here, and that the fact that is that this young man is a young black man
who is murdered
by Rudolph Bourne. And Rudolph Bourne is a visiting professor at Columbia. He has an international connection, and this boy has nothing. And in fact, it's Adam Walker has nothing, and the murdered boy, Cedric Williams, who's only about 17, really has nothing and is mentioned briefly as found in the park with 20 stab wounds. And I have to say that that's an issue throughout this book, including the fourth section that you don't like, Diane, the issue of race, of people of color being invisible. That's one of the things that's going on in this book.
Yeah, what else did you make of the title, Invisible, Neely?
Well, that's how the one thing that I had highlighted I wanted to read you. It's only mentioned one time in the book that I could find that.
No,
it's
twice.
I'm corrected
twice.
By my closer readers. And that's writing in the first bit, and that's when Adam Walker befriends a man later on, or actually it's a friend of his from college who apparently goes on to be a very successful writer. And Adam is stuck wanting to write about this experience in 1967. That's one of the central things of the books, is that he revisits 1967. But what the his writer friend tells him when Adam becomes stuck is that he had the same problem in an earlier novel. And he says, my approach had been wrong. By writing about myself in the first person, I had smothered myself and made myself invisible and made it impossible for me to find the thing I was looking for. I needed to separate myself from myself, to step back and carve out some space between myself and my subject, which was myself, and therefore return to the beginning of part two and begin writing in the third person.
But see, that's what leads me to wonder whether the whole story becomes a figment of Adam Walker's imagination.
Well, we have some evidence of that. There is the second section involves an affair that Adam has with his sister, and that we learn later on that the sister denies it flatly and doesn't understand why he would concoct such a tale. So if this is something that Auster does. He wants to unsettle our notions of, you know, what is fact and what is fiction. But to the question of what invisible means here, I think it goes back to Rudolf Born. I think it goes back to these sort of these sickening forces that find their ways into people, and the kind of power that he has to create this sort of like moral corrosion in people.
Yeah, there's another section that mentions invisible. If I could just read that quickly.
How long is it?
It's three sentences.
Okay.
This is when Adam goes to law school and he's writing to his friend. The idea was to do some good work, to work with the poor, the downtrodden, to involve myself with the spat upon and the invisible, and see if I couldn't defend them against the cruelties and indifference of American society.
Lisa Page, she's a freelance writer, creative writing teacher. Short break, right back. Okay, here's our first email as we talk about Paul Auster's novel Invisible, which many critics, including our own Mark Athatakis, has called Auster's most successful work of fiction. This email says, the only Auster novel I can truly say I appreciated was Moon Palace. Each new one that comes out, I read, hoping I'll enjoy it as well as that earlier work. And each time I've been disappointed. To varying degrees, they seem pointless and build to a final page that ends nowhere. Mark.
I think that can be a fair point. There is one recent novel of his, Oracle Knight, which I've described as the worst novel by a writer worth reading. But, you know, I think he's had a very interesting run. I think a lot of it is very interested in, comes out of his interest in politics and domestic life. I mean, I think Man in the Dark is an excellent political novel. I think Sunset Park, his last novel, is a very strong story about family. People complain that Auster doesn't have strong emotional attachments to his characters, but I think of late he's changed that.
What about his own family, his own attachment to his own family, his own background?
Well, his very first book was actually a nonfiction book called The Invention of Solitude, which is a memoir about the death of his father. And, you know, I think if you want to make an argument about Paul Auster having a sort of strong emotional feeling and being able to write about family, that is a good place to start. Think very closely about family relationships.
Do we have any hints of his own family relationships in this novel?
We have something about his academic background. He was a 20-something Columbia University student in 1967, but I think that's where the story begins and ends here, at least in the context of this novel.
Here's an email from Allison, on the other hand, who says, I'm a huge Auster fan, particularly Timbuktu, which is the one I interviewed him for, and Mr. Vertigo. I read Invisible when it was published, and for the first time in decades was so engaged I could not put down the book. So, you know, I think there are an awful lot of widely held feelings here, Neely.
Well, it's interesting that the writer mentions Mr. Vertigo, which is probably my favorite. I don't know that it's the best, but it's one of my favorites of Auster's. And it's because I think it's so different. It's out of context, or it's much different from a lot of his other stuff, which tends to happen mostly in New York, which tends to mostly be about writers, which tends to mostly involve a very chance meeting, which then, you know, it takes on a life of its own, and everything evolves out of this one chance meeting. And I found Mr. Vertigo really charming. It's different. It's about an orphan in post-Depression America right before the Depression. Mm. And I just really found that to be just maybe because it was just a little bit different.
There's one other personal factor about both Adam and his sister Gwen. They've lost their little brother, who drowns when he is 7. And apparently they get together each year. The family sort of gets together each year to celebrate the young boy's life. But the mother and father really have a hard time with the loss of that child.
Absolutely. And this leads into what is one of the more difficult or troubling sections of the novel, I would suppose you'd say, which is when Adam and Gwen carry on an affair. And I think for me, reading this the second time, I was interested in how well Auster sort of prepares you for this. He mentions very early on that Rudolph and Margot are second cousins. And he talks just about a lot of the sexual fixations that that Adam has. And once you start getting into this sort of emotional despair that he's feeling at the loss of his brother. So it feels off-putting when he begins this affair, but it doesn't feel so repulsive that you cannot read it.
Do you agree? Neely?
Yeah, no, I thought I really admired how he set that up, because in the beginning, what he mentions, Adam mentions that, you know, my brother drowned when he was very little, and he just mentions it. And as a writer,
he just mentions it. Yeah.
There's not much more to it. And then later you say, oh, well, that's, I guess, all we're going to hear about it. But then about 100 pages later, you really come into that had created this crater in his life, in his sister's life. And it's because of that depth of feeling that they shared about their lost brother that creates this emotional space that they had for this affair.
You made the argument earlier that actually the affair also comes out of witnessing the murder of Cedric Williams, that Adam is so distraught over this period, this happening as well, that he's vulnerable to this relationship. Isn't that what you said?
Yeah, and I think there's another thing to think about as well, is that one of the first bits of evidence that Adam has that Rudolph is not trustworthy is that when he gives him a bunch of information about his family, about, you know, you have these parents in Jersey, and, you know, you lost a brother, and Adam is very put off by that.
Well, like, not just put off. I mean, he's stunned. Yeah. Where does this guy get all this information? And that's when he really does begin to believe he's an agent for a foreign government, or, you know, maybe the Russians, maybe France, maybe he's a double agent. I mean, I did get totally taken in with the first three portions of the book. This last portion, and again, racial elements enter into that last portion, Lisa Page, when he is taken, that is, she,
Cecile.
She is the daughter of Helene. And Helene is a woman who is apparently about to marry Bourne. And Adam Walker finds out about this, and he wants to stop this marriage from taking place because he thinks Bourne is evil. So he thinks he's going to get revenge or retaliation? I mean, how does he go about doing this?
Well, he wants to prime Helene and Cecile to inform them of how evil Rudolph is. But I think in the context of the novel, it means to paint Adam as falling down a rabbit hole that he really ought not to go down. He talks to Margot, and she tells him, don't do this, stay away from this. You'll wind up as crazy as I am. And, you know, I think it's more evidence of just the sort of power that Rudolph has over people's lives, because it proves to be somewhat ineffectual. He winds up breaking Cecile's heart. I mean, it doesn't really accomplish. Rudolph does not wind up marrying, but it's not necessarily a product of Adam's efforts. So it seems like, you know, the message there is that he shouldn't have expended that energy. You know, it wasn't worth it to kind of feel that sort of anger and hate and vengeance flow through him.
Mark Atheteck is. He's a writer, editor, critic, and blogger. Lisa Page, freelance writer, creative writing teacher at George Washington University. Neely Tucker, staff writer for The Washington Post magazine, author of Love in the Driest Season, a memoir of adopting a baby in Zimbabwe. If you'd like to join us as we talk about Paul Auster's novel Invisible, I invite you to join us. 800-433-8850. Send us your email to drshow@wamu.org. Feel free to send us a tweet or join us on Facebook. I do see that this death of Cedric Williams, the young black man, really does affect Adam Walker in ways that may, in fact, drive him a little crazy. What do you think, Mark?
I think this book is a long series of things that kind of slowly drive Adam crazy. I mean, I think that is, one thing that happens in this scene is that, you know, you're not sure if Rudolph is doing this intentionally. That's sort of the vibe that you get from it. Like, you know, he's actually looking for somebody to murder. The way that Auster describes it, he likes to write in a noirish tone. He likes accessing that sort of thriller-like language. But there's something that's kind of flowing underneath here that suggests that Rudolph is just, you know, he's just out for blood.
And that scene is so brief. Mm-hmm. They're confronted on the street mm-hmm. by this young black man mm-hmm. who wants to rob them, and all of a sudden Bourne pulls out this blade. Mm-hmm. Now, what's a Columbia University guy walking around with this blade for? And then immediately stabs the guy right in the stomach, and then drags him over into the bushes somewhere. I mean, the whole scene can't take more than a page, and yet it's filled with drama.
Yeah, it's the central event of the book. Adam Walker is never the same after this. His entire life, you can argue that. I mean, he's very distraught. He's attuned to the racial aspects of this, and later on spends his life. He gives up poetry and becomes a lawyer, more or less, for impoverished black people in Oakland. He marries interracially. I mean, you can read as much as you like into that about what effect this had on Adam. So it is the transformative event in the book. It only takes a page or so, and I think it's the best evidence in the book that Rudolph really is a double agent. He's a secret agent, because he pulls out a switchblade and uses it very effectively. He tells the kid, like, look, you don't want to do this. Mm-hmm. And the kid says, give me the money. And he says, okay, I told you not to. And then dispatches him pretty efficiently.
Mm-hmm. you agree that that is the central event of the book.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, I think it is interesting also that, you know, he took the career path that he did, that, you know, this whole experience with Bourne put him off his entire life path, that his ambitions to, you know, run a literary magazine, he wouldn't want to do that because that has the sort of this horrible kind of taint of working with Rudolph Bourne in it. And that, you know, he wants to commit himself to a moral cause. And I think what happens in this entire year for him is that he loses his rudder in being a moral person. You know, there's in the second section with his sister, he talks about when his brother died, he stood up in front of a mirror and said, I am going to be a good person. I'm going to be a moral person. And it completely collapses when he begins this affair with his sister.
So why does Bourne take such an interest in Adam Walker?
Well, his sister believes that he's sexually interested in him, that he's fallen in love or infatuated with Adam Walker when he meets him, even as he sort of plays with the idea of Margot really likes you, so I'm going to invite you over to dinner because Margot is worried about you. The truth is he's interested, he's attracted. That's the sister's theory. And I think it's possible. But I think that there are a lot of things possible in this book, Diane, and I think that that's what Auster's really messing with here is the fact
that you don't know.
Yeah, you don't know. You don't know what is real, what is true. Invisible. So many things are invisible here.
And in all our lives. Mm-hmm. And you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. For some reason, I think it's because you all are so interesting. We haven't had any callers yet. I am waiting to hear from people who want to talk about Paul Auster's novel, Invisible. Call us now, 800-433-8850. Then the question becomes, was Adam Walker truly seeking revenge when he went to Paris to try to stop this marriage when he inevitably knows he's going to run into Bourne somehow?
Yeah, and it's interesting that Bourne finds him, which again sort of tells you that he says, well, what are the odds I'd ever run into Bourne in Paris? I have this opportunity to go study abroad. Adam translates poetry, translates things from French. He wants to become very fluent. So he says, you know, I'll go to Paris. I'm never going to run into this guy. And he's there like 15 minutes and Bourne appears, you know, saying, well, look who's here. Mm-hmm. So, and it again gives you that idea that Bourne knows much more than is apparent in the book, that he is not a lot happens with chance with Rudolph Bourne. You get the idea.
Mm-hmm. Do you agree?
Yeah. And I think, you know, there's something almost a little bit comical here, but kind of typical of Paul Auster. Somebody says very early on, just because a thing is unlikely to happen doesn't mean it won't. But, mm-hmm. you know, that's something that's kind of like Paul Auster's motto. So the idea of, like, you know, trying to escape Rudolph Bourne, but, you know, him kind of integrating himself into his life again is just very much in keeping.
And Lisa, why did Margot stay with him as long as she did?
Well, she is a sort of a not very clear figure. She's troubled, obviously, because she ends up committing suicide. She's troubled in some of the descriptions of sex that she, her sort of depravity, if you will. She's all over the place, is what I'm trying to say. And her staying with Bourne, I think she's attracted to him. She's into him, but she's not real rooted. She calls herself crazy anyway. I mean, she's beautiful. That's as far as I got.
I think, you know, in some ways there's something about a person who claims to understand how the world works that is seductive to various people here, that, you know, he knows how the world works in literature, so that's something that Adam is attracted to, knows something about geopolitics, even though he winds up having these screaming matches with Cecile later on when they disagree about French politics in 1968. But, you know, he carries authority, he carries knowledge, understanding, strength. These things are all very seductive and very hard to escape.
But the women in this piece altogether, I kept trying to figure out what was going on with them. You ask about Margaret. Well, I'm also asking about the sister. You understand how he is all in love with his sister, but you don't understand how the sister is all in love with him. Yeah. And the only woman you really get inside is Cecile, and with her diary in the end, which is minuscule anyway. You don't get the motivation behind the women.
The one thing that about Rudolph Born is that if you he's the one truly competent person in the book. Mm-hmm. He is the one person who pretty much can't
evilly
competent, but nonetheless, he's the guy who makes things happen. Mm-hmm. You get the idea that the other people are all sort of bouncing off things that happen to them. Mm-hmm. Rudolph Born makes stuff happen. And I mean, he's obviously, I think he's almost the central character in the book, that Adam is sort of Adam takes up most of the space. He's the one who tells the story. But the real central presence to the book is Rudolph.
Mm-hmm. Neely Tucker. He's staff writer for the Washington Post magazine. Lisa Page, she's a creative writing teacher at George Washington University. Mark Athatakis. He's writer, editor, critic, and blogger. We are talking about Paul Auster's novel, Invisible. I see the lines are filled. When we come back, we'll open the phones. Stay with us.
National broadcast of The Diane Rehm Show is made possible in part by Visa, whose Visa Signature credit card offers access to the movies this summer. Details at fandango.com/Visa Signature. By CSX, whose trains move a ton of freight nearly 500 miles on 1 gallon of fuel to help reduce fuel consumption. CSX, how tomorrow moves. And by Novo Nordisk, since 1923 committed to diabetes care and areas of unmet medical needs, at novonordisk-us.com. This is NPR.
In The Hangover, Bradley Cooper worked with a tiger. In The Hangover Part 2, he works with a monkey who plays a cigarette-smoking drug dealer who occasionally panicked.
Crystal would just claw into my shoulder. I was, like, bleeding. I had scars, and we kept saying, she has her shots, right?
Bradley Cooper on The Next Fresh Air, and John Powers talks about Cannes. Join us.
The book we're talking about for this month's Reader's Review, Paul Auster's novel, Invisible. And let's open the phones now, 800-433-8850. First to Windham, New Hampshire. Good morning, Jerry. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. I'm wondering you're saying the fourth section was just no, couldn't go there with it. And the panel, how long do you stick with a book before you put it down? Or would it occur to you to say, I'm not going to read the fourth section?
Oh, no. Once you get into it, I mean, there's no putting it down. But the other problem with it is that I'm speaking just for myself. I realized as I was reading this how utterly ridiculous the fourth section seemed to me. Now, Mark, I know you felt very different.
I was willing to tolerate it, I think, more than anybody else in this room. And I think, you know, there is a certain preposterousness to it, right? I mean, like, you know, here he is on this Caribbean island where, you know, he is, you have to climb up, you know, there's no road to get up to where he
lives. And this poor 50-year-old woman, she hadn't been told she's going to have to climb.
Right. I think you have to read this as just a symbolic representation of just what are the consequences of living a life being the sort of evil person that Rudolph Bourne is, that he is, you know, he's meant to be described as sickening, repulsive. You know, Cecile goes to have dinner with him and he orders, this is a hot Caribbean island, and he wants this like thick gravy filled meat sort of meal. And, you know, it's meant to be off-putting, and it's, you know, he proposes to her. I mean, this is sort of the end of the line for somebody like Rudolph Bourne. This is, you know, you are utterly disgusting.
What do you think, Lisa?
Yeah, I had a different feeling about this section. I thought that Auster really did want you to understand that Bourne probably murdered Cecile's, or tried to murder Cecile's father. He was turned into I guess he's a vegetable. He's hospitalized.
Right.
I also thought Cecile's response to the servants, there are three servants serving two people for dinner, her response to the black people on the island, chipping away at the rock, and that sound will never leave her memory, is political. I really felt Paul Auster was being political there. He's talking again about the invisible people who don't have all the money and the power.
Who do all the work.
Right.
Who do all the work.
I thought that's what
Neely.
I kind of wanted, I guess I'm just old-fashioned, I just wanted a little bit more of a payoff. That we'd come all this way. We wanted this stuff.
Me too.
That you set it up. Poor old Adam. I wanted Adam to be redeemed. I wanted something to happen there, that Adam as he's dying, as I don't know if we've mentioned this part of the book, but at the he's writing this memoir that he doesn't get to finish. This poor man has had his life destroyed by this chance meeting with this guy. He did really nothing wrong. He tried to, you know, avenge that. It didn't work out. He lived the rest of his life doing good work for the poor. He tried to write this memoir.
And then gets leukemia.
And then gets leukemia and dies. Give the man something.
Let's go to Val in Cincinnati, Ohio. Good morning.
Good morning. I have, I guess, a very different take in that as a psychotherapist, it struck me that Bourne has to be a sexual sadist also, and that his evilness, if you get into that whole realm, and why the woman would why she stays with him, that can be very seductive. It's power. I mean, evil is very powerful.
I agree with that.
Oh, no, absolutely. And I think, you know, when you look at all the cast of characters in this novel, they're all people who are, to some degree, easily manipulatable. I mean, you know, Adam is a young man. You know, Cecile is a young woman when he falls into her orbit. So we don't know much about Rudolph with people of his own, you know, when he's going head-to-head with, like, you know, maybe his fellow intelligence agents or, you know, but he lives a life, you know, I think it's just that he's tortured people, that, you know, he lives to have opportunities to lord it over other people. And I think that certainly plays into his romantic relationships.
Now, here's an email from JT, who says, I've been a Paul Auster fan for many years now. I feel each time out, he writes the best three quarters of a novel you've ever read. The fourth quarter leaves you wanting to throw the book at the wall. Still, that three quarters is so engrossing, so perceptive, that you're happily willing to read the next book. He writes each book like a man who is looking for something, can see it in the distance, but never really finds it. Invisible is no exception.
I think he would do just great if he would just let himself go for once and just write. I think he may be the best crime writer in America. If he would just say what I am, you mentioned that he likes to do some Norris stuff. A lot of his books turn on one central act of violence. There's one act of violence in the book. So yeah, I think if he would be just fantastic if he just turned it loose and said, I'm just writing a crime book here. And you know, with all the conventions, I'm going to stay within the genre, but do my thing. I would love to read that book.
But, you know, I mean, this one, what was the movie with Coleman, Ronald Coleman, Shangri-La. You know, I mean, this climb up the into the wilderness, I mean, totally put me off.
Well, you know, I think maybe going back to something that Neely was saying, if we want the satisfactions of a novel, how much Auster maybe wants to challenge us to say that maybe we don't want that, because there's toward the end where Bourne wants Cecile to help him write his story, but to make it a novel, and you can feel him like he's rubbing his hands together. Yes, it will be a thriller. Thrillers are so wonderful. Isn't it a wonderful word? But, you know, real life doesn't have those sort of satisfactions to it, and I think Auster is trying to push away from, you know, that sort of conventional ending, that sort of, I don't think Auster wants to write. I don't think he's challenging us from wanting a happy ending. We want resolution. But, you know, it's not going to come in the form that we want, where Adam is redeemed necessarily or where Rudolph is put in jail.
And Lisa, from your perspective as a creative writing instructor, you feel that it was extraordinarily well done.
I do. And I think that for what he's trying to do, which he's trying to play with the structure of storytelling, he's trying to play with perspective, with the unreliable narrator, with point of view, with form. All of those things are going through this novel in the course of his trying to write a memoir. So it's almost, somebody called it like Russian Dolls inside of Russian Dolls. And that's the point. That's the point. It's not definitive. It's not, you don't get to leave and say, oh, this is what happened.
Yeah, but the problem is he's playing with my mind.
Oh, I understand.
And that's the part I don't like. Let's go to Jacksonville, Florida, and to David. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. I have not read the book, but just listening to the discussion, it almost seems like a society, an allegory of our cultural, political society today. I mean, you know, the best part kind of takes our unconscious and brings it into the present. And talking about, you know, the sociopath or lack of empathy, the hangers-on from further back, and cultural touchstones from the past coming forward, the competence and incompetence of followers, and a few incompetent people that seem to be competent but are not, just seems like the time of our society and politics today.
Interesting, Mark.
It's somewhat illegal to read the author's life too much into the novel that you're reading, but, you know, we know that Paul Auster is a very politically engaged person. He is a part of the Pan American Center. He has spoken out against torture. So I think there's certainly, his books are very much informed like this. His previous novel, Man in the Dark, is very involved in themes of torture and the war in Iraq and the way that political discourse happens in America. So I think that, I think it's fair to read it as an allegory.
Is he particularly American in his writing, or does he have an international appeal? Neely?
I'm going to cheat and say both. I think there's obviously an American nature to what he does. But does that appeal to people in other countries? Sure. I don't think it's exclusive to the United States, because a lot of what he writes about are ideas and times. And the focus is often very small. It's just a couple of people and a couple of situations with larger events in the background.
Well, if so, he doesn't paint us very prettily. Let's go to Manchester, Michigan. Good morning, Doris. You're on the air.
Good morning, Diane. Thank you for having me.
Sure.
I have a question about the incest in the book, and I wondered how your panel feels about whether it actually occurred, because the author seemed to interject a little question about whether it was real.
Well, that's the unreliable narrator aspect of this book. According to Adam Walker, this actually happened. According to his sister, Gwen, who is interviewed by the editor, it never happened. It was all his imagination. And by the way, that question comes up in other ways in this book as well.
You mean his imagination?
His imagination. What really happened? And again, this is the unreliable narrator is a literary construct that is used throughout literature. But here, it's like Auster's asking us to understand that there is no truth there is no objectivity, or truth is your version and here's my version, or truth is what I want truth to be, or truth is my imagination. All of these questions. And again, I bring that back to the title of Invisible, in the sense that it you can't see it. You can't always verify it. You want to. That's why you want a definitive. That's why you want a definitive ending here.
I would put my $2 bet would be that it happened. That was my.
That's your $2.
That was my $2 bet. You'd have to believe that you have a dying man who's writing a book, right? That's not going to be seen until apparently after he's dead. I don't get his motive. And she says everything else in the story happened. Everything else is.
Doris, what do you think?
Well, that makes sense.
But I mean, you've read the novel, I presume. So
yes.
What did you think?
I love the novel. I thought
okay,
it was
but did you
but
think?
I thought, I believed it at first. And then when she denied it, I began to wonder about it.
Yeah, but wouldn't you deny it?
Well, absolutely. I mean, absolutely. She's got a husband. She's got children. She's
absolutely.
Got grandchildren.
Absolutely. That's why it becomes, you know, even that much more questionable as to who is telling the truth here. And I am when I say you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. Let's go to Paul in Orange Park, Florida. Good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Thank you very much. I'm always looking for good authors, great authors, actually, to read. And I appreciate the detailed information you gave me about this particular story. It's definitely going to be coming in from Amazon in the next few days. I think people want to hold authors to some standard of reality versus unreality, and does the construct, does the plot of this novel fit into my construct of reality? We'll get over it. I mean,
I'll try.
All fiction is based in part on real life, and all real life contains fiction, and each of us has our own little fictional interpretation of real life. Another example is dreams. If you dream at night when you're asleep, you can dream anything, and it's okay. But if you dream in the daytime, it's called hallucinating, and you're considered to be psychologically unbalanced. I read because it explores the deep parts of the human mind and helps me better understand other people and myself. So I hear, you know, 5 stars for the author and your show, of course.
Thank you. All right. Well, I do hope you enjoy the book. To Peter Barrow, New Hampshire. Good morning, Paul.
Good morning, Diane. I had two points. One was about the sister Gwen's relationship and her denial of that. I'm not sure she denied it so much as just didn't want it to come out because it was it would affect her family, her immediate family, her children, and she preferred that didn't come out, so preferred that she use some other name. And then the other thing was at the ending. I disagree with you about the ending. I think it was kind of interesting, and it reminded me, in some sense, of Shalimar the Clown, in that it portends some degree of rebellion on the part of the people who are most downtrodden, and that Bourne didn't prevail in his last attempt to control the life of somebody else. She came off the mountain and rejected his absurd proposal, which was kind of his last attempt to control somebody else, and in effect showed the limits of his power. And I don't think you've discussed the broader implications of this and what the larger themes that Paul Auster was trying to explore here.
What do you think?
You know, as far as the ending, I think the novel that he mentioned was Shalimar the Clown by Salman Rushdie, which I haven't read, but it's interesting to hear that parallel. You know, I think with Rudolph in the end is kind of an absurd, kind of helpless character. You know, there's something he says very viciously, and it's just a very quick bit where he tells Cecile, you know, you'll drown with all the others, all the billions of others, and all that will be the end. How I envy you, Cecile. You'll be there to see the end of everything. Mm. And there's you know, there's that old Rudolph-born viciousness, but it's also just, you know, he feels childish when he says something like that.
The only thing I have to say about that is that I think it would have been more realistic had it taken place in a hotel room in Paris rather than in a cave on a Caribbean island with strange people around to lead her up the hill. The novel we've been talking about is titled Invisible by Paul Auster. Thank you all so much. I enjoyed your comments. Thanks for listening. I'm Diane Rehm.
The Diane Rehm Show is produced by Sandra Pinkard, Nancy Robertson, Susan Neighbors, Denise Couture, Monique Nazareth, and Sarah Ashworth. The engineer is Toby Schreiner. Dori Annesman answers the phones. Visit drshow.org for audio archives, transcripts, podcasts, and CD sales. Call 202-885-1200 for more information. Our email address is drshow@wamu.org. And we're on Facebook and Twitter. This program comes to you from American University in Washington. This is NPR.